Okay.
And then,
well, welcome to our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. I'm John Beck. I co-direct our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. So it's wonderful to have you all here. A couple quick announcements before I introduce our speaker today. Almost 2 weeks from today, actually on the 23rd, the Monday, Elise Freeman and Gary Cunanan are going to be here from the Minnesota Discovery Center. You might remember Gary is one of our speakers about the 1913 Michigan copper strike. And they've recently finished a documentary, exhibits, and other things in relation to the anniversary of the 1916 Mesabi Iron Range strike, which was a major, major conflagration in Minnesota. That talk is called A Foretaste of Hell in Minnesota, Work and Rebellion on the Iron Range, 1916. So I'll just hand those, if you would just take one and pass them on. And then we still have a couple more coming this fall in November, so I'll pass on the entire schedule. And now we'll get started. So I first met Jeanette Unit a few years ago. I got very interested in her work. As many of you know, I go in and out of South Africa each year. So Jeanette is a Cape Town-based artist and has been connected as well as an instructor at the University of Cape Town. And Jeanette has given her life to looking at things geological, things both above and below the ground in relation to the lives of miners and others that are involved in that. And her art expresses what that stratigraphy of labor, what that stratigraphy of geology actually looks like. So today, we have for at least another day her exhibit up at the ARCA on the second floor of Snyder Phillips Hall that comes from some of the work that you'll be seeing. And I commend it to you, and you might want to come over and look at that. Do sign in if you haven't signed in. And Jeanette, we also share her brother, who was one of my students at that time, the University of Port Elizabeth in the Eastern Cape of South Africa. I was one of the supervisors of his master's thesis, actually an external reader of his master's thesis. So with that, let me introduce my wonderful friend and speaker, Jeanette Unit. Please welcome her to our Daily Work, Our Daily Life.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being here today. It's a real privilege to have traveled. I've just spent a week at Colby in the geology and science department. So it's been quite fun to actually engage with scientists, which I feel a very privileged place, social science, and the kind of multidisciplinary aspects of the project are seem to be picked up, which is really very, very exciting. So the video you're seeing is, as I said, it's of a smelter. This is an iron ore mine. Which actually connects to where those crazy Yokohama fenders are from. There's an 800 kilometer, that's about a 400 kilometer mile distance, and apparently the longest, it's referred to as the longest train in the world, but that transports the bulk ore out of South Africa into China for the making of various motor vehicles and so on. And in fact, I did their headquarters in 2008. Only half of it, because it was a credit crunch, they had to cut the job in half. So there you go. I'm always kind of a little bit uncomfortable with this type of program, but I think I am ready to rock and roll. Let me just check one last thing. Right, so I'm going to start at the beginning of my project. Shall I start? Oh, shabbat. Yeah, no, I will. That's fine. And seems fine. Um, So my project started in the 1990s. I got engaged to someone who ran diamond mines, and I'm just opening this thing up. You're the genius at this, right? Slideshow, will it go onto that side? From the beginning. Coming, okay, good. And the flicker won't work, so I'll just use my hands. Right, so we can put the main lights off, can we? So the project started on the Orange River estuary in Namibia. The diamond mine is on the right-hand side, and the estuary is on the left-hand side. And also, I used to walk between the estuary and with flamingos on the one side and this strange man-made mountain on the right-hand side with a 12-foot security fence. Well, it was actually like really, really high, more than 12 foot. It was about 12 meters with like guys in little towers. And the second prospect I went to was down in the 3 hours from Cape Town. And I was horrified to see it. My first response and my first connection with mining as something that I was interested in was that I was horrified that these were the same age that I was, but they were unrehabilitated. They'd been made by De Beers in the early 60s. And along with them were these rusting trommels, were these rusting machines that actually separate the diamonds. But as a modernist, somebody who likes abstract work, I suddenly saw these things and there was a huge potential to make artworks. It was like, fantastic, here's the shape and form I've been looking for all my life. So I took a million photographs and broke up with him and continued to try and transform this project that kind of seemed relevant, would seem like it would be a 3-year, 4-year, 5-year project, but just actually become so compelling, so interesting, and has morphed and taken so many angles, which I hope I'll take you on that journey in the next half hour or so. This is the first artwork I ever did. This took about 5 years to make. It sat around, it floated around my studio, kind of waiting to be finished, waiting for me to, because at that stage there were only four artists I knew about who'd been working in any way with mining, and that I will touch on them later. So there's a whole series of these earth scars, and that was the name of the first exhibition shown at the University of Cape Town as a shock response to mining. Minerals, and there were quite a few more drawings. And then sometime after we'd broken up, my ex sent me this photograph of a sustainable mining practice where the topsoil looks more dramatic than the other thing, but this is actually sustainable. The topsoil is very shallow because it's quite desert. It's quite a desert. The plants mainly live off the ocean mist. The topsoil's moved. The overburden, which is the material that's irrelevant to mining, it's not the ore, is actually scraped out. And then they get to the bedrock, get their diamonds, and then they put everything back and put some plants. And within 3 years or so, the whole thing is actually, you know, it doesn't look like it's an earth scar. An earth scowl, as the Romans called them in England. The Romans were obviously colonizing England at that stage. So these are just some gravels that were taken from that. I mean, they could have come as, they get washed down with glaciers and rivers. They come from as far as Lesotho. That's from an iron mine that you'll see nearby, that jasper, the red jasper. And this is literally diamond gravel. Sorry, you're a geologist. Oh, it is beautiful. I mean, the whole earth thing is incredible. This is from the diamond mines. This is from Kimberley's diamond mine. This is a client who's rehabilitating. Now, inside this volcanic crushed gravel, this is right from Kimberley, is you'll see as you get closer the olivines, the garnets, the ilmenites. There's a whole range of minerals, and of course, ilmenite and rutile, which are in those, become titanium, which is the most ubiquitous white pigment that we have. So literally they're taking the out of this, the big hole, and they're transporting it into the De Beers hole, but taking any of the diamonds that have actually eroded out of it. And again, a feast for somebody who loves abstract forms, and from which I made a whole lot of artworks. And I also did this client's work. This is an iron ore mine. As I mentioned earlier, this is diatomite. This is from the Rift Valley. This is used in making dynamite. Oh, diatomite, I spelt it wrong. Sorry, I left a T out. Beg your pardon. And this is going underground in the gold mines. This is Ibwasi, it's in Ghana. It's remote, took me 6 hours to get to Kumasi by bus. It was a conference on African independence, and then I traveled for 2 hours into the forests with a guide, with somebody who I just met through someone reasonable. And I think that says urinal, but some spelling's gone wrong. Mining towns are dusty, they are dirty, they are often quite depressed. The people were sitting around. I never photograph people. You might notice it's a kind of respect thing. I don't glamorize poverty. There are artists like Peter Hugo, who I'll mention later, where there's a kind of, they call it the pornography of poverty, you know, where people actually take advantage of it. I can't bring myself, because I know those photographs will actually be used in ways that they have no control over. This is still Ibwasi. And this is, of course, the Ashanti gold. In the time of the history, gold was exchanged for salt in equal proportion. Salt was more valuable because salt, actually, you need salt to live. The human body needs salt to function. So the salt actually meant more. And a lot of these things were salt weights. So they're very beautiful. This is actually, it's owned by Anglo Gold Ashanti. So this image is actually in the front book. It's where the contents page is. And when I walked into the museum for Anglo-Boer War, the Women's War Memorial Museum in Bloemfontein, does anybody know about the South African War? Yeah. I walked in, and I happened to walk in on the day that their internet had crashed. So all the staff were sitting in the staff room, and they were all looking very bored, and they were really excited to have somebody to speak to. And they took me all off to Vianen, which is an old concentration camp site, but it was also the city dump, so it's not an archaeologically pure site. And they helped me collect stuff from there, which obviously with me, everything becomes paintings, because I mix it into an acrylic. I buy up to 100 gallons of pigment at a time and work on paintings. When I first met John, I was completely filthy and had my assistant, and we were making a painting as long as this room, but made up in sections. In fact, it's as randomly as it is, it's actually this painting. It's not in the presentation. That was about 5 years, 6 years ago. So when I walked into the museum and showed this image, they'd saw it in a draft of the book. The one man said, yes, there were 5 reasons for the Anglo-Boer War. Gold, 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 and gold. The British Commonwealth, the British Queen and country, whatever, had sent troops from Canada, from Australia, I think it was 170,000 troops against the 30,000 Boers. And because of this gold, the Boers knew the land, they had farms there. It was also one of the first mass media wars in South Africa. A lot of conflict happens because of minerals. This is the point I'm making. The British actually invented the concentration camps. Now, I showed these images that are coming up to a friend of mine who is from the Royal Benin Line I've confused myself. Anyway, the point is that South Africa's gold wasn't possible without coal. Not only did coal fuel the Industrial Revolution, it also, without a source of heat to smelt the gold, that wouldn't have been possible. They found the copper mid-1600s in South Africa, but they could only, the original people, Khoisan people, came with beads and jewelry and interacted with the settlers, and they realized that there must be big copper deposits. But they could only start releasing that copper when the Industrial Revolution, the railways, and they connected. It's about a 2-hour drive from Kuiperberg, Copper Mountain, into the coast, the Port Nolloth coast. And as Duncan Miller says, the copper of Namaqualand electrified our colonial masters, but actually left the bleakest, most environmentally devastated area and the lowest unemployment in South Africa. It's a really tarnished landscape. But so the proximity of the huge coal deposits near the Witwatersrand allowed for gold to be smelted. But then also I made a map. Sorry, I'm trying to move forward. Okay, I made a map. Well, what's happening? Are we frozen? I don't know why it's doing that. No, that just stick there. Sorry. Okay, so I. Maybe I've got two slideshows going at the same time. A PowerPoint slideshow. Oh, where are we? Okay, I'm just going to keep going with that. Did we get on to something else? No. Something's gone wrong. Actually, I shouldn't be able to see it. Oh, I should be able to go here. Yeah. Okay. So in 2014, I went to England, and I walked into the Royal Geological Society in Burlington House, and there was a map. This map actually is as tall as that rail, and it's hand-drawn. Do you know about the map, the William Smith map? And he made about 400, and he was so accurate. One man traveled 10,000 miles, but his job, he was a canal engineer, so he understood the strata, how all the layers of strata, and also which layer the coal was positioned at. And this map was made in 1814, a contemporary map. If you look at them side by side, it's so, so accurate. Anyway, he was extraordinary, and I was fascinated with him, and I met a very generous academic called Owen Green, who is at Oxford University Earth Science, and he collected earth strata for me. He collected, he informed me about geology in a way that I couldn't actually have ever understood in such a large area as Africa, because if you see the scope of Africa and the scope of America and you see the scope of England, it was quite easy to zip across, and I did more than 10,000 miles understanding the map and following the cross sections. But it also led me to realize that they knew that they were running out of minerals. Britain knew that there was a finite quantity of coal, there was a finite quantity of copper, a finite quantity of tin. And this compelled the colonial impulse. They needed to actually find more resources. And it was one of the things about coming down to, you know, expanding the empire was high up on mandates to find the coal and copper resources. So, I'm just saying that there's a malintent, we get into one of the... This is an environmental picture. I've diverted here. Yeah, that's beautiful. That's actually another artist. I'm bringing this in. This is Batinsky's from Canada, photographing nickel tailings. You're obviously aware of him. I just went out of sequence, as you might have realized earlier. And then this is a furnace in my studio, making all this whole artwork is a little bit bigger than this. It's about as big. It's 2.6 meters, 2.5. It's about this big. So it's a bit expanded. It is all made out of waste, all from mines and from the dustbins of glass factories. So it took a year to make, starting on Christmas morning, because I was so excited with my new kiln. But by using waste and toxic waste sometimes, from the spectrometer, you can see that there's toxic material in there. You actually realize that I'm trying to make a connection between the sort of story of soil, the story of earth, the toxicity of things, also the magnificent beauty of things. I mean, humans have an irrational love of inanimate objects. Apart from our opposable thumbs, we also have an absolute love of what does a stone do? What does a piece of obsidian do? Can we cut it up? Can we use it? Can we make something of it? These massive steel machines that actually are all possible because humans have worked out how to use materials. So this is the copper that was, this is 1886. This was Oom Fani. He took us on a, he was our guide. So he sold us a big, I think you've seen them at my studio, a big rather ugly crystal from the Orange River. But that was actually the first prospect. And I'm using goop from near the smelter, and I've got water in it, and it just, it's leached such a lot of wonderful colors, and it curdles my paint, then I stabilize it. I mean, I work geologically and outside, so there's sort of the color that's coming off that is somewhere between those two green poles. Literally, that's copper verdigris off the... I've got samples of some of the mines here that you can have a look at afterwards as well. So another project was the headgears. I started working with the archive. I'm having the third exhibition with them now. I walked into the archive about 2008-ish, that area of time, and suddenly there was a big photograph saying no cameras. So I spoke to somebody in the reading room where you access the records, and I said, what can I give you that you can let me take photographs? So she said, well, we need stuff that makes people interested in the archives and makes them aware of it. So I said, can I give you an exhibition, and then can I use your archive? And she was like, great, that was the first project that actually came out of it. So they've got 45 kilometers of records. That's about 20-something miles. So I started looking through their images, and I just decided to stop at the headgears. Firstly, they were fantastic sculptures, and I wasn't going to go through another 45 miles to make an art exhibition because these were so beautiful. I didn't know about the Beches at this point because it echoes, even the way I displayed them was very much like Hiller and Bernd Becher, but I've consequently seen their work. This is a photographer who really admired. He's a German scientist. You know him? Yeah. And it's also called Jeanette. He sent me this photograph of a blast furnace, which I thought was quite appropriate when I'm in a tiz. I think it's a mine in Wales, but he and the Beches have pretty much documented the sort of disappearing landscape. This is Peter Hugo, who I mentioned earlier. He has this kind of quite exploitative look on Africans. And there's this waste plant in Ghana. And then Ernest Cole took photographs of the mines, lived in exile for many years. He was a brilliant photographer. And as a black man, he had the access, well, he's an African man, he had the access to, he was a photographer from within rather than kind of somebody looking outside in, if you know what I mean. I think that was quite important. So even a photograph like this, which is, if it was David Goldblatt, it would be, or myself, it would be exploitative. It becomes something else that it's Ernest Cole taking it. And just the degradation that men went through when they were accessing and entering the mines. But again, we look at it with that gaze on the African body, and it's actually propelled a whole lot of artwork, which I'm going to show now. David also took these photographs of going underground where there was an enormous amount of dust which clammed up his camera. He said it was really difficult, one of the first times he'd ever gone underground. And I remember finding this photograph in our art school's library when I was about 15, 16 years old and just thinking this really sums up South Africa in the kind of, without saying, you know, that the mine manager would have two baths. It's kind of... And, you know, you'd imagine that... Okay, so this is what I wanted to come to. So this is where I got lost early on. I inserted some slides. This is... So we're talking about the gold. And my friend Peju Lawayolo, who comes from the royal line of the Benin family, which is in Nigeria, had come to stay with me, and she was looking through a book that I had called The Suffering of War. It was about the Anglo-Boer War. And she said she couldn't believe that these were white. She said she couldn't believe that white people were doing this to white people. Her uncle is the Obi of Benin, and her great-great-grandfather was the Obi King of Benin at the time of the British sacking, 1897, you know about. So she was absolutely horrified when she saw this photograph. What not everybody realizes is that, and I'm sorry, I have got British blood, I also have a bit of German blood, so I can sort of feel I can talk about these things, is that Hitler was inspired by what Britain did to the 30,000 Afrikaners who were fighting on their land. Horrific pictures of the carnage of war and kind of civil, you know, hitting civilians. And this is just something I found in an archive, which a lot of black people were very badly treated. African people, sorry, that's not PC in America. But a lot of African people fought on either side with sort of various promises. And there was a Treaty of Vereeniging following the Anglo-Boer War where the African was very seriously betrayed, because they'd fought on either side, they'd been in concentration camps that were terrible, they'd actually participated in this war as gun bearers, as all sorts of things. And then when it came to like actually sharing the spoils of war, they were actually sidelined. And it wasn't long after that apartheid kicked in. A very, very close friend of mine, Joe Farragher, who passed away about 10 years ago, he showed me all the glass. He was my absolute hero. He'd been an underground miner. He was an Africanist. He knew about the chemicals and the materials. He opened my eyes. He showed me so much. I just have a lot to thank Joe for. I have many people to thank things for, actually. Sammy Belodi is one of my, I really admire his work enormously. He's from southern Lubumbashi. Lubumbashi is the southern part of Congo. And he took archival images and he took current photographs of the Jeka mines and he superimposed them and created this series, which I'm going to flick through. I think he's somebody well worth looking up if you aren't aware of his work. And as John said, he exhibited at the Smithsonian. So again, the gaze on the black body, again, the kind of colonial, you know, like what Picasso would take the masks and turn it into. There was always this appropriation of both culture and minerals. And I believe that what we've replaced colonialism with is much, much more subtle, much more nefarious, is actually neo-colonialism, a kind of, people with numbers on their legs. I mean, how dehumanizing is that? Sorry.
Is the nakedness to make sure they're not sneaking a diamond out or something like that?
I don't know. These were images he found. It could be. I mean, I know that people were treated pretty horrifically. I know with the diamond mines that they were placed in heavy mitts to actually control. You know, they couldn't put in. Diamonds fluoresce. So, I mean, I was living on diamond mines. I mean, there were stories about pigeons, carrier pigeons, and then, you know, someone would find a really big diamond and they'd attach the carrier pigeon, a big diamond to the carrier pigeon. The poor thing flapped and couldn't get over the fence. He landed on the security van's roof. People have an innate greed as well. Everybody has a kind of love of shiny, colorful minerals. I think it's kind of quite a human thing, but of course diamonds have a tremendous value. More of Sammy Belodi. The kind of colonial interests, absolutely wonderful work. The Jeka mines have been restarted. The mines are now payable. Fred Simba works with bullet casings, empty bullet casings. He welds them together to create forms of figures. Interesting. Pat is a good close friend. I've stayed at his house in Alexandra often, and I've worked with his wife, Bongi Dilmore. When I did a residency at the Bag Factory in 2003, Pat took me to, you know, he would go and collect these spades and make that absolutely lyrical sculpture. He has a handling of material, he collects things from scrap yards. He's got a work, a beautiful work in the Smithsonian that I saw when I was here in December. He's quite an underrated artist, and this guy is magnificent. He was the Lion of Africa, a Lion of Venice, in the Venice Biennale. He takes bottle caps. And he has like huge teams of people working for him. I'm quite interested in waste because I'm working with detritus. So the artists I'm mentioning work with the leftovers of mining or the leftovers of industry or the leftover metals. So these are bottle caps, but they reference the Kanti cloth in Ghana. And they also are luxurious and magnificent. And they kind of stitch together and they're the size of like, even taller than double the size up to of this area, not just the screen, but like five times, six times the size of the screen, if not more. He has teams making them, referencing that type of very, very magnificent. Papa Essel, obviously also Ghani, but also references the underground and mining and so on. And a friend of mine, Wayne Barker, he has looked at land and desire. He's kind of embedded these texts into works and looked at Pierre Neef, who was a classic kind of Afrikaans, regarded as kind of owned by the Afrikaner, and who painted the landscape in South Africa. Again, the Beshes. It's an artist named Michael Christian Batinsky using waste, but in the grid. I'm fascinated by the grid and geospatial modeling, and I've put some stuff out here that you can have a peep at and scratch and sniff. He also looks at, Boltansky looks at the Second World War, and I think that sometimes bits of South Africa have a Second World War feeling about them. I met Cyrus Kibera in Kenya in 2009. He's actually just gone huge. He's really, really, he always uses recycled material, and of course what you have is the one comment is the gaze on Africans, but there he's got this pair of spectacles that gives you a different gaze from Africa, which I think is an interesting irony. And I think it's. And Fabrizia Matera, I don't know her. She works entirely with waste, but in the most elegant ways. I mean, this is a fantastic transformation of material. Cables into sort of a big kind of marvelous, marvelous imagination. Okay, so back to my work. I'm interested in the idea of consumerism, conspicuous consumption, and this is my old passport, and I realized it had the same number of bars that you have in as countries in Africa. So, coincidentally, and I'm also working on these very, these kind of paintings that I call barcode or geoscene paintings. They are made with minerals. We are all the same. We are all walking, talking minerals. If you look in a vitamin bottle and you look in my paint containers, what you have is pretty much walking, talking mineral or unwalking, talking minerals. So there's a kind of, I'm drawing that connection between the two, but I've also been researching for this artwork, which I call, at the moment, one of the working titles is Who Owns Africa? It'll be a very large work because the panels are about like this high, and they would be circulating a space continuously. I cannot find spent about a year and a half, and I've got some pretty good connections in mining and geology. I've spent a year and a half, and I still haven't found a comprehensive list anywhere on which mines are owned by whom in Africa. And of course, without transparency, you can get away with all sorts of rape and plunder. So this is, I'm working in the book that I'm working on, a sort of geological kind of format. This is largely made with gold mine dust, titanium. And just to give you that, this is a lovely, the little dark-haired lady, her name's Paris Broom, and she's taken a lot of photographs for the next book, so she deserved to be in a picture. So back to above, below. As you can see, I traveled to a lot of places, and although there were some installations I've done with this work, it was also like although I love the minerals and I love the photographs, I also want to tell a story about these sort of places. So this is the first place the first mine that I started working from. I did visit a uranium mine when I was 18. So this is in my, let's say, early 30s. And it's a combination, and then worked into with minerals and sands, as you can see from collections. And this, ironically, is it's underground in Cape Town, that section of the drawing. It's underground in Cape Town at my lawyer's. It's a piece of reclaimed foreshore. And it's kind of really kind of interesting. But, I mean, I've also got interested in the law, because the law is mightier than the pen in terms of, like, controlling. I mean, you know, South Africa had an agricultural and hunter-gatherer economies that were colliding and intermarrying and interconnecting, and that's why you've got the cliques. So along comes the settler and says, hey, here's a piece of paper. I own that piece of land and that piece of land. I mean, it was a completely foreign idea. The title deed is an extremely powerful piece of paper. And of course, keeping those records in archives is also about holding that power. With the next book I'm working on, Complicit Geographies, I'm looking particularly at how humans, and I'm trying to do this visually, which is challenging, but how, and it's taking time. It's taken 5 years so far to visually develop the newer work from Terra. How humans use the earth, how humans create wealth out of the earth, how humans measure, survey, divide, create borders and boundaries, and allocate that wealth. I mean, the whole idea of title deeds and mineral rights, water resource rights, those, that goes as far back as Sumeria. It goes back to the earliest farmers. As Duncan Miller says, the problem with humanity, with the problem where we're at now, is it is a consequence of humans committing agriculture. About 12,000 years, we started planting and needing to own land. That need to own land has created a lot of consequential problems. So I'll repeat that image. That is called a Yokohama fender, and I find it interesting. It's a bladder. They're huge. I mean, they're up to like. The long ones that you'll saw in the video, they're like this big with tires around. Okay, you can see from the tires how big they are. And my great-grandfather was born, well, grandfather and my great-grandmother were born in Japan, in Yokohama. So I kind of like the name, and it kind of, I mean, obviously I'm not Japanese, but it stops the big ships from breaking the walls of harbors. So you've seen the ones on the red ones that just got the lots and lots of dust. And then that's actually an aerial photograph of an open pit mine, a very low res. And then on top is obviously an oil rig. And this is that's the headgear of Kimberley while they were reconstructing they're making the museum there. So it's actually through the construction wire. And then that's a piece of something I found on the harbor, just a photograph. So they kind of, they're juxtapose, and then I've worked into them. So to platinum. South Africa has 85% of the world's platinum, between 80 and 85%. And these are just some samples with my periodic table in the background. I made a painting after the massacre. Greg Maronovich. Spray painted, well, no, he took photographs of the police spray marks of where the bodies had lain against the rocks. So they kind of was.
Give them a little background on Americana, since they probably don't. Many people.
Oh, right. Oh, I must give. Okay. So Americana, So basically, Americana, platinum, we have this huge wealth. On the 16th of August 2012, it was the end of a period of striking where a group of laborers had been really frustrated trying to get $1,000 a month salary. These men are of high prime fitness. They work with jackhammers, but they work horizontally with them into the seams of the Marinsky Reef, my great-grandfather's best friend identified, geologist. And they were just trying to speak to say, look, we're not coming out. We're not coping with this. You know, our living quarters are squalid. Like, please, can we just get an increase? And management just kept on giving them and kept on barraging them, which includes our deputy president in South Africa, who's actually lost his presidency because of what happened as a result. He sent an email saying, let's sort of end this problem. Now, my big problem with Marikana, what happened was these men were blocked and blocked and blocked. The police decided they'd had it. You know, government on the highest level was involved, and emails were sent to the head of police. And on a particular day, this 3:30 in the afternoon, they had literally corralled an area around a mountain top, a small mountain kopje, and the miners had congregated on that kopje, and they'd used, you know, big razor wire to like. And then they'd use caspers, which are very nasty looking. They kind of give you that fear thing of apartheid. because they were used in the townships in during the apartheid era. But these huge police vehicles were corralled along the one side, so the kopje was surrounded, and then the miners were coming through, and they were literally being herded into a corner. Like, literally, they had nowhere else to go. They came out through one area, and they were mown down. But for me, the worst thing about Marikana, the worst thing was that they didn't just have ambulances there. They actually had mortuary vans there before they killed people. That means they had an intent to do what they did. So the artworks that I've produced, this one just recognizes the slain people, but the next work, I wanted to acknowledge that it's sort of memorial to the, and I used the blast pattern. You know, when you go through a tunnel, they have to blast the ones, and then they blast the twos, and then they blast three, and then they blast four, and then they get the maximum effect of that blast. So there's a kind of intent to destroy the area so that you can access it. So I used the idea of a blast pattern, the kind of, and this was the exhibition that was sponsored in Germany last year at the Ostwall, Museum Ostwall. This part of the tesserae here is the last remaining bit of the old mine headquarters on the Ruhr Valley, an area that I was visited in 2015 and 2016, and was sponsored heavily by the Department of Arts and Culture. And they're so happy they've asked me to apply for more money, which is quite a nice thing to actually get from a sponsor. And I wanted to create the room. You know, the geoscenes are supposed to connect with each other, so they kind of create the barcode, but I wanted to create a sense of an altarpiece acknowledging the lives of the miners, and the fact that somehow Marikana, it ends, it basically shows that the transformation, that the apartheid, end of apartheid, hasn't really worked. When this happened, with the control of a black and African government, we have failed in our transition, we have failed in a process, we have failed our people, and this is what this work was about for me. That's my talk. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Oh, sorry, the time.
So, we'll open it for questions. And you saw a number of the images in her Paradoxes of Plenty. Three of them are over at the Residential College, and then you saw the head frames. In the one case, she has chalked over her drawings of the, so it was bright yellow in one case. Some of those are over in different colors and just in black and white over at the Residential College. So Jeanette's work comes out of an interest in geology, but it's also representative of who owns Africa. It's also representative of who's the boss and who's the worker and other things in terms of the images that you've seen. With that, would you do me a favor and just flip the lights, because that way we know where we all are.
Do you want to pass around?
Okay. So with that, questions, comments about Jeanette's work in all of the mines across Africa, and the floor is open. Questions, comments?
You said you got started in the 1990s, but when, like, specifically did you know that this is what you wanted to do?
As an artist. When did I want to be an artist? When I was 14. And that's actually, I'm very old now. So it's actually, well, it's kind of like a long time ago now. I'm now 53, so that's 40 years ago next year. Become a celebrant. No, well, it's a very long time, you know. 40 years of doing something is quite a while. But I knew I liked the smear and the smudge. I knew the art room was my space. But, this project opened up. I mean, I'm going into, like, maps, and it's just, it's wonderful. I mean, it's unbelievable. It just, it's a journey beyond journeys. I mean, I'm working with Department of Geospatial in South Africa gave me almost the whole of South Africa, or she tried to. I think some recycler came before I got there. And I've got the big sheets, the negatives, and this is from Oxford University. I've got a pile of that stuff, and it's very exciting to make
Neil?
Art with.
Neil?
Yeah, I'm just curious. You raised the question about that we don't know the answer to. Who owns which mines in Africa? I spent some time in Sierra Leone a long time ago, which of course is known for alluvial diamonds and then the blood diamonds and the whole thing. And in those days, there was a lot of smuggling going on. And they would smuggle the alluvial stones from Sierra Leone through Liberia. And Liberia became listed as one of the sources for alluvial diamonds, which was not the case. They were all smuggled. But what De Beers did, and I knew some people that worked at Charterhouse in London, what De Beers did is that they set diamond appraisers in Monrovia, as well as the ones in Sierra Leone. So no matter where the diamonds were smuggled, how, whatever, it all ended up. And in those days, about 80-some percent of the diamond production in the world, including the Soviet Union, were marketed through De Beers.
Yes, yeah.
My question, I guess, is, has that broken down? Are there more independent that we know of owners, or is it still Anglo-American owning the whole shop?
I think that kind of control might have actually been dispersed, but I'm not 1,000% sure. I mean, there are issues like you're not allowed to own. There's a tiger's eye. You're not allowed to own tiger's eye, which is not fossilized, but it's asbestos, I think. Mm-hmm. But you're not allowed to own a rough diamond. So that's to control, and that's definitely a South African rule. That's to control. And then at one point they said that they could identify which diamond came from where. I mean, you can get pink diamonds from like Australia, and you can get yellow diamonds from the South African area, but you can get, like, diamonds are diamonds. You know, they're compressed carbon, they're not that rare. And in fact, what's really important about diamonds is that every single thing in this room, every single thing in our world is actually made with a diamond. If your clothes aren't made directly with a diamond, the machine that makes those clothes is made with a diamond or diamond polish or cut with a diamond. So we are dependent on them for industrial reasons. I always say, like, you know, when I first started, I was like more superior than the miners. And then when I, you know, you point your finger in one direction and then these three fingers point backwards, you realize, oh, I'm using titanium. I'm using, like, you know, a cell phone. I get on an aeroplane. I mean, everything we do is actually so dependent on mining.
And let me just make a comment on the Americana piece that Jeanette had up. That those were the names of all the miners that were killed at Americana, and then the yellow X on the bottom, in case you didn't totally get what was going on in that piece. And much of her work, and you at the end, you might want to come up and see some of the layered things and other things that she brought with her. There's a buildup of the ores and everything else that are part of these canvases, even in the case of the Americana one. I mean, it's just a good amount of dirt, in effect, on the canvas because of the subject matter. Other comments or questions about the work?
Yes, it seems like some of your presentations are at least partly critical, if not fully critical, of the mining process, especially the control of mining. Do you ever have a sense that criticism has limited your ability to get access to materials?
The interesting thing is that the mining industry and the people in it, the captains of industry, are actually, they know that you know, it's like basically, they know that you use what they use, and if they didn't drag it out the ground, you know, they can take it on the chin. I mean, you know, basically they know what they're doing, they know their dependence, and it actually doesn't, I mean, I do criticize, and I mean, I'm in a bit of a quandary right now because, I mean, I just thought that I had a nice friend at Impala Platinum, and she sent me bags and bags of platinum slag. This is from the slime pond. I've got all these things here. This is from the smelter. You know, here, she didn't say they're going to need artwork at some point. Well, anyway, the next minute, I mean, she's now asking for the artwork, but I've met, all I've got is Americana pieces. I can't give that to her. That's a bit kind of, it's a bit harsh. Like, so it's a kind of quandary of using their materials to have actually made a social commentary against them. I didn't realize that their reason was that they were doing their headquarters. So and I do need to think more commercially sometimes. It might benefit all of us.
One question, Jeanette, because you've traveled in East Africa to a degree, as you indicated. I think the one thing that to Neil's question about who, you know, figuring out who owns it, one thing that's going on, not unlike the British Empire, is now the Chinese Empire. That is, that the Chinese have moved in dramatically into Africa for the purpose of being able to make sure that they have access to minerals that they don't necessarily have in China. Did you see that when you were going around?
When I traveled, I saw, you know, there's a lot of stories about, I mean, there's a lot of factual stories about, you know, there's an agreement between the Chinese about the pavement and the roads, because infrastructure's, you know, I've driven on dirt roads for 3 hours, and then suddenly you'll hit like the tar road, you know, the metal road, and like literally like 3 meters later is a turn off to a mine. So you've suddenly, you know, they're protecting their vehicles by actually creating a better road. So you've seen roads, I've seen construction sites with Chinese people on them. On my list, and I really do have, like, you know, I've got the Chamber of Mines, I've got Mining Atlas, the various info mine, and we got into the, my one assistant did some work and got into the back door of that by being charming, and UCT's green mining and the whole mining initiative that they've got. I've got contacts. So they've shared, they've given me stuff. I mean, I've got one contact who's given me like a list this long of this, you know, Excel, 750 mines in Africa. Really? Is that it? Is that all? In that continent, you saw that one photograph. That's nonsense. I mean, there's 1,500 mines in South Africa. How can there only be 750 mines? So, and I mean, on that list, there are about 10 mines owned by China. So the transparency, the lack of transparency is the thing that's actually the problem. I mean, Goxi, the World Bank has got a website called Goxi. It's useless. I've communicated with them. They didn't even come back to me. It's kind of like a fig leaf. It's like, we're doing this like nice thing to sound good. But they're actually doing nothing. They're not. There's nothing proactive about it. If they were really interested, this is interesting information. Who owns Africa? Don't you agree? Yeah.
Other questions? Chris?
You talked about barcodes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've used a triptych, like a kind of, you know.
Can you say a little bit more?
Well, you know the altarpieces in. So, I mean, one of the things I do with artworks is there's a kind of. I'm not saying that it replaces religion and doesn't replace God or ideas about faith or anything, but I'm saying that there is a kind of thing that's going on where people consume as a kind of religion. And that, apart from the fact that it's supposed to be an altarpiece, you know, it's kind of not the idea of it being an acknowledgement of a life. But all the works are, all my vertical works are two squares. So like a figure could stand in that shape, if you know what I mean. All the paperwork, so even the headgears and even the above belows that were, you know, that's that format. But the triptych is a classic religious format, yeah. But like it's subtle. I mean, it's not. You can interpret it or not interpret it. Yeah. And they're the height of a human, of a tall human.
And would you talk a little bit about the occupational safety and health? Because much of what you've ended up creating, some of your chalks are actually toxic. And the mine tailings themselves that you use are toxic. Would you talk about that?
Well, I was very careful. I wanted to bring this over because I've been in some science departments in Colby and the geology department. So I wanted to bring over things that were interesting, but I was really cautious about. I do have some gold mine dust. I mean, there's a lot of uranium in Maine because the glaciers, apparently the mountains in Maine were as high as the Himalayas and were scraped away by glaciers. So there's a quite a high The houses have to get tested for radon in Ray because of the off-gassing or something of the uranium. I don't quite know how it works chemically. But Johannesburg is a major supplier. I mean, a lot of gold and uranium is found together in certain pockets. Now, I know I've got a little piece of gold mine dust. I can see from the color, and there's a gold mine passport. But I can see from the color that it hasn't got any uranium in it. So that was the one I brought over from the one that to take my whole bag and become a terrorist or something in customs. That's why I also want to leave these things here. It's much, much less stressful than me. I'm not going to get your design and clothes there. I'm not going to worry anything about it. So these are little bottles. Another thing I avoid bringing over. I worked when I did the Tronox project. That is for the biggest titanium producers in the world, in their headquarters. They gave me zirconium, which is used in ceramics. It's used in, you know, if we didn't have ceramics, by the way, we would never go into space. Does anyone know that? Because ceramics can tolerate better heat than metal. So zirconium, they use it on the new type of dentures, implants and things like that. Titanium. The zirconium is used on the whites. And I've got some white knives, so just ceramic knives, that I've got no metal, just zirconium. I also want to put those in my suitcase to make them long for anything else, because I think they're quite spread. Anyway, so yes, I do use materials, but like this is particularly lead molybdenum, and you'll see it there. And then I've got a picture. You know, this is how I know that I've got uranium, because this guy's got one of these machines, and he's kind of interacted quite a lot. And this is the next book in the earlier editions. And here, you'll see a picture of my dog looking very hieroglyphic to heaven. But that's me making red pastels carefully. So I do use gloves and a respirator to make sure that there's no, the worst case of contact for radioactive material is actually underlines. So, yeah, I'm careful. And I'm doing workshops, it's like pastel workshops, which, you know, everybody makes sets. I can use like completely neutral, nothing that would harm, especially kids. You know, we imagine how bad that would say.
Other questions? I have one for you, Jeanette, and maybe this is uncomfortable for any of us that are artists or writers. Or one thing that's always been said to me as a labor historian is, well, do the people that you write about actually read what you say about their history? Well, in this case. How much of your work is actually seen by the miners or by mine unions, and how has that been received?
I showed the group, like the mining work of Ernest Cole. That's we had an international mining history conference in Johannesburg in 2012. Just before, it was really well sponsored, actually. Hugely well sponsored, and National Union of Mine Workers was one of the sponsors. In fact, part of the Maritime thing was a battle between two unions, the rising of the National Union of Mine Workers was like the most successful union in the world. Anyway, they saw the work. But mostly the people who view the work is because of mining and Java, where I've had the sponsored artist four times, the mining artist. And which is the second largest mining conference in the world, it's the biggest decision makers for Africa. And then I was also the Earth Artist through that Oxford University connection, another of the professors was on the board of the geological, blah, blah. Anyway, the point is that the top guys get to see my work. So one student in the environmental class called me, said to me, you said it's okay for miners to damage environment, and I said absolutely not. And I would go out to someone on the Forbes 100 or Forbes 50, there's probably about 50 of them are at mining, and I'd say, you may stop delivering, and I'll make art about it if I feel. I mean, I don't really want to criticize Impala Platinum,
because they went to the specific mine. It was Lonman and Tiny Roland. Does anyone know about Tiny Roland? Mm-hmm. Tiny Roland was, he's worth looking up now. He, R-O-W-L-A-N-D, he went and made deals with all the presidents in Africa. He sold them out. He promised things that he never delivered. He is the reason that African independence actually failed. One of the reasons, one of the big reasons. He's an absolute, and he was a middle class kind of guy, you know, British kind of very hierarchy, social hierarchy. He was always aspiring to be part of the Mayfair set, you know, part of kind of, you know, British upper class. He would never quite make it. But apparently one of the things he said when he was flying in his own plane up Africa, he said, You see down there? I don't mind any president down there. And he looked rather unfortunate. And he was one of the Lonro and Lonman, it was one of his original projects. So it has a kind of history that isn't very nice.
Are there any other questions or comments? Let us give Jeanette another round of applause. And you really have to come up and see all of the wonderful things that she brought with her. And as long as you don't eat the molybdenum, you'll be fine.